we're talking about a man who, at the very essence of his being, almost destroyed democracy in one day, and he wants to do it again. He wants to run for president to do it again.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a lot harder for him to run for president now without a business empire.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
But we'll see.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
It is, isn't it?
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me. Jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California in Red Bluff and Redding, on KFOI in Round Mountains, KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast, on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's Queso, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Can you tell I've got good news to start the show? Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, in Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for what is already, so far, a thrilling edition of the Bradcast, and I have not even begun yet. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hey, lots of breaking news,
so, yeah, this story breaking within just the past half hour or so sort of throws off all of my plans a bit for today, but that's okay, because anytime there is a terrible ruling for Donald Trump in one of his many court cases, well, I'm happy to rearrange everything else.
You are right
in order
there
to cover
Johnny
it.
On
I'm
the
there
spot.
I'm there for you. From AP, just within this last half hour, a New York judge has ruled that Donald Trump and his company and his two eldest sons and two top executives all committed fraud for years while building the real estate empire that catapulted him to fame and the White House. Judge Arthur Engoron, ruling Tuesday in a $250 million civil lawsuit brought by New York State Attorney General Letitia James, found that the former president and his company deceived banks, insurers, and others by massively overvaluing his assets and exaggerating his net worth on paperwork used in making deals and securing financing. As you hopefully know by now, Trump had obscenely overinflated the value of his own properties by billions of dollars. In fact, he even lied about things like the square footage of his Trump Tower penthouse. I think he said it was 30,000 square feet. In fact, it was 10,000 square feet. Stuff that is easily checkable and not in any way subjective like that. You could just measure out his apartment and find out how large it was. All of that in order to get bank loans, while using much smaller numbers for the very same properties when paying taxes or buying insurance on them. The court's decision comes days before the start of a non-jury trial in James's lawsuit against Trump and his kids and his company. And it is the strongest repudiation yet of Trump's carefully coiffed image as wealthy and shrewd real estate mogul turned political powerhouse. Turns out he wasn't a shrewd real estate mogul after all. He was a con man who has now been caught. Beyond mere bragging about his riches, Trump, his company, and key executives repeatedly lied about them on his financial statements, reaping rewards like favorable loan terms, lower insurance premiums. Judge Engron found on summary judgment before the trial has actually begun, simply based on the facts presented by both sides, Trump's tactics crossed a line and violated the law. According to the judge, he rejected Trump's contention that a disclaimer on the financial statements that he gave to banks absolved him somehow of any wrongdoing. That disclaimer hilariously warned that, well, pretty much all of the numbers inside this financial prospectus are not to be believed. They were not vetted by anybody, and they could be entirely wrong. In other words, Trump just made up the numbers and felt that putting a tiny little warning at the front about that was, well, that was good enough, and that they should go, you know, go do their own due diligence before believing him on anything, because who would do that? Trump has argued that that's just business. That's the way the New York real estate scene works, baby. The court today has found otherwise. In fact, the court has found that that is fraud. Manhattan prosecutors had looked into bringing a criminal case for the same conduct, but for reasons that still remain unclear, they declined to do so, leaving the attorney general instead to sue Trump in the civil case and seek penalties as much as $250 million that could, as AP politely describes it, disrupt his and his family's ability to do business in the state. Bigly.
Very much so.
Engoron's ruling in a phase of the case known as summary judgment resolves the key claim in James's lawsuit, but six others remain, along, I guess, with the determination of what and how much the penalties will actually be. Remember, this is the same woman who essentially put the once incredibly powerful NRA out of business entirely in New York State, where they were based. As you said, you had some, because as I said, this is all just coming in,
right?
And it was unclear. I hadn't even seen the ruling yet. Is there a written ruling out at this time?
There is a written ruling out. I have also not had time to read the entire thing, but Andrew Feinberg, who's a reporter for The Independent, says, if I'm reading this right, Judge Engron has found that Donald Trump committed fraud and has ordered the cancellation of all of his New York business certificates and the dissolution of the Trump Organization. Now, neither he nor I nor you are lawyers, but this is what it says. Ordered.
This is what the judge says. Okay.
Ordered. Yeah. And I transcribed this directly from the final page of the ruling. Ordered that any certificates filed under state law, well, filed basically under state law, by any entity defendants or by any other entity controlled by or beneficially owned by Trump or Don Jr. or Eric Trump or Alan Weisselberg and Jeffrey McConney, those are canceled. And it is further ordered that within 10 days, the parties are directed to recommend the names of no more than three potential independent receivers to manage the dissolution of the canceled LLCs.
So these are companies owned by Donald Trump and his kids and whoever that are actually being canceled?
It seems entirely. Like that. Again, I am not a lawyer, but that does seem to be what the judgment says. So I look forward to hearing about, you know, more about this as the actual lawyers get in and read this and explain to us what it all means. But that does appear to be what it says.
Meanwhile, the trial has not even started yet. The non-jury trial, again, this will be before Judge Engron, the one who made this decision today, just minutes ago, that is slated to begin October 2. He'll have to decide those other claims and any punishments he may impose, at least above and beyond what does he suggest is in that ruling that has just come out. Letitia James is seeking $250 million in penalties and a ban on Trump doing business in New York. That's his home state. The trial could last into December, the judge has said. Trump's lawyers had asked the judge to throw out the case entirely on summary judgment. He denied that and, in fact, decided the key part of this case on summary judgment in favor of the state. Trump's attorneys contend that the Attorney General James was not legally allowed to file the lawsuit because there isn't any evidence that the public was harmed by Trump's actions. And of course, you know, there will be appeals on this.
Sure, but it's kind of silly to conclude that the public isn't harmed when you're cheating on your taxes.
Well, there you go. You should be an attorney in Letitia's office. But what they're trying to say is, look, the banks did this on their own accord. We warned them. They could look it up. They decided to loan us this money. We paid the money back appropriately, et cetera, et cetera. That's what they're claiming. So nobody was harmed. Now, yes, you're right. In fact, if they didn't pay the taxes they were supposed to pay, then the public was harmed. But that's the argument that they're going to be making here, that they are making here, that, yeah, sure, he may have lied, he may have committed fraud, but really, who was harmed? They also argue that many of the allegations in the suit are barred by the statute of limitations. So we will see what happens. Make no mistake here, while the criminal cases pending against Trump, including, as I recall, 34 felony counts for fraudulent business transactions in New York related to his hush money payments, payoffs to a porn star to help him win the 2016 presidential election, those cases, that one and the other two federal cases, one for trying to steal the 2020 election, the other for stealing thousands of national security documents, et cetera. Those cases are pending and they could, yes, end up sending Trump to jail. This case, on the other hand, could bring his entire business empire down, which, you know, is what his run for president in the first place was built on. So, you know, don't kid yourself that, you know, this doesn't matter, that, oh, he's really worried about the criminal cases. This is huge. Even if this case has received much less coverage in the media of late. Again, that trial, the bulk of which he has now lost before it has even begun, begins next Monday, October 2. So that's not the only good news I hope to get to today, but it's a good start.
It's a definitely an interesting one.
Yeah, I've got a lot of other stuff that I now hope to get to today, including, by the way, Desi Doyen's Green News Report later this hour.
Yep.
Our only one this week, thanks to coverage of this week's second Republican presidential debate on Wednesday night and our special coverage of the broadcast the day after. By the way, after we got off air last night, the RNC announced that just 7 candidates were invited to participate in the next debate. It's being held at the Reagan Library out here in California this week. Former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, who was there last time at the first debate, he failed to qualify this time. The 7 who will be there for this second debate include former Vice President Mike Pence, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley, Senator from South Carolina Tim Scott, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, and they call him businessman Vivek Ramaswamy, and North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum. Donald Trump, who said he will not participate in any of the 3 scheduled debates, was actually not invited to this one, despite being the far and away front runner. Still, he apparently failed to meet the RNC criteria that requires, among other things, a loyalty pledge to support the eventual Republican presidential nominee, which I guess he won't sign because that's how loyal Donald Trump is to his Republican Party. So I think this is both somewhat germane to both Republicans and to the ongoing conversation, the warnings we have been issuing on this program regarding this nation's ongoing critical battle at this point for a future of either democracy or autocracy, or as some prefer, democracy versus fascism. You'll recall the bipartisan U.S. House January 6th Select Committee's star witness last year at their live televised hearings before Republicans eventually took over the House majority this year and did away with that committee entirely. was Cassidy Hutchinson, who served as the top aide to Donald Trump's then chief of staff, Mark Meadows. The now 27-year-old, and apparently still Republican, offered explosive testimony during her live appearance before the committee back in June last year when she detailed, among many other things, the fact that Trump was aware before his January 6, 2021 rally of the potential for violence at the U.S. Capitol that day and that he did nothing to prevent it, that he supposedly tried to join the insurrectionists at the Capitol and even grabbed the steering wheel of the presidential limo and had to be physically restrained at one point by the Secret Service, that he watched the attack on the Capitol at the White House on TV for hours in the dining room next to the Oval Office and did absolutely nothing, showing no concern about his supporters attacking the Capitol and as they chanted to hang Mike Pence, and that Donald Trump and an attorney that he had paid for her had tried to encourage Hutchinson to testify dishonestly to the committee. That's just some of the stuff she testified to. Well, now she has a new book out about all of that. It is titled Enough. And while I suspect she'll be making a lot of rounds on media in the days ahead, so you'll see a lot of her, she did offer this comment last night during her first televised interview since her testimony last year with MSNBC's Rachel Maddow on Monday night. I think it's worth taking note of this remark from Hutchinson, who was, at the end of Trump's term, remember, the chief of staff to the chief of staff, Mark Meadows. As a then 25-year-old, she nonetheless had a front-row seat to all of the madness of the final months of the Trump administration, and she now offers this warning to her fellow Republican voters and, frankly, to all of us, I think.
I can't speak to the psyche of my... I won't say my fellow Republicans because I do not think that we are a part of the same Republican Party. I still consider myself a Republican. I consider myself a Republican in the sense of Senator Mitt Romney and the Reagan Republican Party. I believe that the Republican Party needs a strong conservative party. I do not believe that Mr. Trump is a strong Republican. But in this next election cycle, it's... In my opinion, it's the make or break moment for the Republican Party. Now is the time if these politicians, these men and some women that are currently in Congress want to make the break and want to take the stand, they have to do it now. We can't wait any longer for them to do it. I don't know why they're so willing to support him. I think it's extremely disappointing and it is not a hard issue to take. We're talking about a man who, at the very essence of his being, almost destroyed democracy in one day. And he wants to do it again. He wants to run for president to do it again. He's been indicted four times since January 6th. I would not have a clear conscience and be able to sleep at night if I were a Republican in Congress that supported Donald Trump. And, you know, I think that if they're not willing to split with that, then we're in serious danger for the party.
Yeah. You're in serious danger for the party, all right. And by the way, we're in serious danger for the country. Cassidy Hutchinson explains there, a man who almost destroyed democracy and wants to do it again. And he's running for president in order to do it again, or at least to try. So as we head into this election year and... whatever may come, please keep that in mind. Please, I want to say vote wisely. I'll probably have to say that another few hundred times between now and next November. So with that warning tucked into our belts for now, another piece of tape that I wanted to make sure does not forever get lost. This one, unlikely really to ever appear again, unlike Cassidy Hutchinson's remarks, but it was brought to our attention last night by the Daily Kos's Walter Einenkel, a U.S. Senate subcommittee hearing on post-pandemic child care was held last week. It featured experts who detailed how little is being done to protect children from hunger, poverty, crime, poor health outcomes, and death. This particularly after Republicans refused to re-up extended pandemic-era tax credits in 2022 after they had those tax credits had actually helped cut the child poverty rate by more than 50% in the U.S., including for more than 5 million kids who were lifted out of poverty in 2021 by this policy. In fact, that Republicans refused to continue. In fact, the child poverty rate actually doubled from 3.8 million in 2021 to 9 million in 2022, thanks to the Republicans. But oh well, what are you going to do? Perhaps that's why Republican governors around the country, including Arkansas's Sarah Huckabee Sanders, are now signing measures to remove restrictions on child labor. Don't those kids know there are no free lunches in this world? Of course you're in poverty. Get back into that slaughterhouse, Junior, and get to work. One of the expert witnesses at the Senate subcommittee hearing on child poverty was labor economist Catherine Ann Edwards, who, as Einenkel notes, was questioned by pretend folksy elitist Republican Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana, who, when he had his chance to question the panel, he made a big show out of the familiar conservative, I would say pretend conservative, talking point. Well, we'd love to help, but how, oh, how will we ever pay for it? He directed the question at Edwards, who gave him a heavy-duty dose of reality.
I've got a bill right now, I think it's paid for, to try to cap the cost of insulin for everybody, including the uninsured, at $35. But, you know, you reach the point where you say, we can't do everything, so the fair question is, where's the money going to come from, Doc?
The majority of federal revenue comes from taxes, so if you need more money, you'll have to raise taxes. I'll remind you, sir, that we have had two massive trillion-dollar tax cuts in the past 20 years, and they have done nothing to make child care more affordable. They have done nothing to help the casualty and property insurance that you were talking about today. They have not been invested in children, and we have not seen that return. I mean, the 2001 tax cuts have now had 22 years to prove that they could solve the social issues that you and your fellow senators say that are a priority, and I don't think we could point to evidence to say that they have worked. I would love for you to give child care 20 years. I would love for you to say, let's take two decades of runway, invest it in young children, and see what kind of return that I could get. But we've never given children or the child care sector as much runway as we've given taxes. And I'll remind you that the estate tax exemption right now is $13 million.
Well, let me say thank you for the honest answer. Raise taxes.
Thank you very much, I'm sure.
Let's just move on now.
Yeah, Catherine Ann Edwards there. Wow, boom, knocked it out of the park. And, you know, of course, it sounds simple. If you actually care about children, particularly care for, you know, children in poverty, as Republicans are now claiming all over the country, even as they ban abortions, they ban books that they believe will harm children, they ban medical care from professionals under the guise that these lawmakers know more about medical care for children than doctors do. Even with all of that, you know, they're, of course, wrong on all of it. But the claim is that they are doing it because they are so concerned about the children, about the well-being of our kids. Well, if you actually care about our kids, raise taxes in order to make sure that they get the care that they need and stop lowering taxes for these rich people and corporations. As Einenkel correctly observes, the Republican Party has had one single policy remedy that they have successfully enacted over the past 40-odd years: tax breaks benefiting the wealthiest Americans. Their newest policy offers, really their only policy offers right now, are the same. More corporate welfare in the form of tax breaks for the rich. Yes, they actually would like to lower corporate taxes even further. So how, oh, how will we ever come up with the money needed to help Americans other than the richest 1% out there? The government's out of money. We can't afford it. We can't help. It's terrible about these children, but oh well, what you gonna do? So good for Catherine Ann Edwards. And you could tell that this was a Senate hearing, not a House hearing, because she was actually allowed an opportunity to respond to that question. from a Republican member in a way that you would never be allowed. It would never have occurred in the Republicans' bat crap crazy U.S. House right now. But more on that maybe in a moment. Also, in kind of related news, just before airtime this afternoon as well, California Governor Gavin Newsom signed a new law that will double the taxes on guns and ammunition. And it will use that money to help pay for more security at public schools and other violence prevention programs. The federal government already taxes the sale of guns and ammo, but the new California law will double that tax by adding a state tax to it, making it the only state, by the way, with a tax on guns and ammo, believe it or not. That according to the Brady Gun Safety Group. So good for California. Hopefully other states with not insane governors who are otherwise busy signing laws to allow children to become slave labor might consider doing the same if they're really concerned about our kids. And speaking of slave labor, in response to my interview last week with UC Santa Barbara labor historian Nelson Lichtenstein discussing the rise once again of the U.S. labor movement and the obscene pay for CEOs at the major car companies who refuse to offer similar to their workers who brought them record profits in recent years and decades while worker wages remained largely flat. Fried Bones at Daily Coast writes, quote, as far as I'm concerned, living wages have deteriorated since single incomes became a problem just to keep a roof over your head and food on the table. In the past several decades, I've not seen where living wages have been in balance with our living expenses. Everything I've seen over my several decades in the workforce, wages have depreciated to the point of being the worst since the Great Depression. But at least during the Great Depression, the government did what they could to help people out. However, in today's climate, the government is divided and the minority screams whenever anything that helps the people is proposed. When you have CEOs earning millions of dollars while their company's employees have to use food banks or food stamps and government poverty programs just to live, that is a sign of a country on the brink of dying, says Fried Bones. Remember all the history of past civilizations who failed? Many died from the inside out due to such an internal upheaval as we are seeing today in the world. The wealthy get wealthier off the backs of the poor and marginalized populace, while the middle class is practically a memory. Fried Bones says, I am glad to see some changes coming. I just hope it wakes up all those wealthy companies into realizing that they are the driving force of decline. Well, that remains to be seen, though, as covered on our program yesterday, the major Hollywood production companies at least seem to have blinked after nearly 150 days of strikes by the Writers Guild of America, even if Hollywood remains largely shut down, with the Actors Union still continuing its strike against the same companies. Meanwhile, the historic week-long simultaneous strikes against the big three U.S. automakers by the United Auto Workers Union is expanding this week and on Tuesday in what is somewhat surprisingly, also an historic first, President Biden joined a group of striking auto workers on the picket line in Michigan on Tuesday in what the New York Times describes as an extraordinary gesture of support to a labor union by sitting American president. Biden joined General Motors workers who were picketing at a distribution plant, distribution center just west of Detroit, then addressed the crowd along with the union's president, Sean Fain, telling workers to, quote, stick with it.
You've heard me say it many times. Wall Street didn't build the country. The middle class built the country. Yeah. Unions built the middle class. Yeah. That's a fact. Yeah. So let's keep going. You deserve what you've earned, and you've earned a hell of a lot more than you're getting paid now. Yeah. Thank you very much.
President Biden at the picket line for apparently the first time in history. Who knew? He was dressed in a baseball cap, a sweater, brown shoes. He put his arm around a picketer as Sean Fain, the president of the union, praised him for being the first president, at least in modern times, to join marching workers. The president, who described himself as the most, as the most pro-union president ever, emphasized that he had been a labor supporter for decades and had picketed before, just not as president. Since the strike began on September 15, Biden has been calling on companies and workers to reach an agreement that would spare a ripple effect throughout the economy that could raise vehicle prices, disrupt supply chains. The White House has been hesitant to say whether Biden supported the workers' demands, but when he was asked whether they deserved the 40% raise that they are seeking, he responded, quote, yes, along with the crowd of picketers on Tuesday. Biden has repeatedly argued that auto companies have not gone far enough to meet union demands, especially after making concessions in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis.
And we should point out that they made huge concessions to keep the auto industry surviving in the 2008 crisis.
Including giving up cost of living increases in their contracts, which used to be there. So as all of this inflation has happened over the past couple of years, their salaries have not kept up with that, not even close.
Right. So that's why it may sound like, hey, a 40% raise, that's crazy. That's insane. But it's actually making up for all the lost time of what they didn't make when they were supposed to.
The UAW president, Fain, said, quote, thank you, Mr. President, for coming to stand with us in our generation-defining moment. He described the union as engaged in a, quote, kind of war against, quote, corporate greed, adding, we do the heavy lifting, we do the real work, not the CEOs, whose compensation packages have skyrocketed with record profits, even while the workers have seen few, if any, of those gains in many recent years. On Wednesday, the GOP frontrunner for next year's presidential contest, Donald Trump, plans to meet workers at a non-union facility in suburbs outside of Detroit. In fact, in a county that voted for Trump in 2016 and 2020, even though corporate media has been misleadingly reporting on this as if Trump is, you know, bravely going to meet with striking workers in Detroit.
He's not.
Which, by the way, Detroit voted against Donald Trump in 2020 by 89 points. Yes, they voted for Joe Biden over Trump 94% to 5%. But sure, yeah, Trump's going to meet striking union workers in Detroit, corporate media. Keep up the great work because, you know, both sides. Am I right? Let's take a quick break here. We will come back with our reorganized program today with some bona fide good news, along with the very good news at the top of the show that Donald Trump has begun to face accountability in New York State, where the judge there has found him guilty of the key charge of fraud in State Attorney General Letitia James' $250 million fraud case against him, against his two eldest sons, Eric and Don Jr., against his company. Let the accountability continue. I'm Brad Friedman. This is The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. If you haven't noticed by now, it's no easy feat finding facts, real facts, not alternative facts, over your public airwaves. We try to bring you real facts, truth, and clarity without fear or favor each and every day on The Bradcast. But we need your help to do it, and that help is needed more now than ever. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate today. It'll take you about 60 seconds, and you can rest easy knowing that we'll be here every day making sense of it all, or at least trying to. That's bradblog.com/donate, and thanks.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine, yeah. This little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine. I let it shine. Let it shine to show my love.
Let it shine. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. As promised, some bona fide good news today out of our stolen, packed, and corrupted U.S. Supreme Court, believe it or not. You'll recall that earlier this year, in late June, the court sort of stunned everyone in a ruling that it had made in a Voting Rights Act challenge to newly drawn U.S. House districts in Alabama, which, despite the mandates of the Voting Rights Act and a black population in the state making up more than a quarter of the population there, just one U.S. House district out of seven was drawn by the state's gerrymandered GOP legislature to be a majority African-American district, guaranteeing in this case that there would be just one black member of Congress from Alabama who happens to be the state's only Democratic member of the House from Alabama. Many of us believed that the high court was likely, as that case, as we're waiting to hear about that case, we thought the high court was going to take the opportunity to gut Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, essentially the last remaining section protecting minority voters still in the act that the Supreme Court has not already gutted, especially since the court had put a lower court ruling on hold that had ordered a second majority black district to be drawn into the state's map. The Supreme Court put that ruling on hold, and that allowed the racially gerrymandered map with just one black district to be used again in last year's critical midterm elections, helping the Republican Party win their very narrow majority in the U.S. House this year. But in its June ruling, a 5-4 majority with Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Brett Kavanaugh joining all three of the court's liberals, the court ordered that Alabama redraw its maps with an additional black majority district, or, quote, something quite close to it, as Roberts wrote in the opinion for the majority. And that was great news. That was in June. The map was then sent back to the state legislatures. We were all surprised by it, but very happy. The map was sent back to state legislatures to correct this problem. And, well, the state legislature and the state's governor, both Republican, sort of stunned everyone again by refusing to follow the mandate of the U.S. Supreme Court. Instead, the Alabama legislators produced another map with only one black majority district in strict defiance of the Supreme Court.
They are so committed to their racist maps. It's amazing.
And they gave that to a panel of federal judges to look at. And the panel, yet again, killed that map, too, said that it was, quote, troubled by the, quote, extraordinary circumstance of the legislators totally disregarding the court's instructions. And the court at that time, the federal panel ordered a special master to draw up maps independently of the state and its legislator and its Republican governor, Kay Ivey, who had blatantly defied the U.S. Supreme Court. The state then attempted to seek a stay on the federal appeals panel ruling against their new, similarly gerrymandered map, hoping to steal, I guess, another 2 years worth of elections as they'd hoped, to flip one of the justices on the Supreme Court in the majority in the previous ruling. Specifically in this case, they were hoping to get Brett Kavanaugh to flip somehow in their favor after he had signaled that he was open to changing his mind about all of this, at least as state Republicans saw it. Well, for now, anyway, he was not. The Supreme Court on Tuesday rejected Alabama's stay request with a simple one-sentence denial, including no dissents from any of the justices. In doing so, the Supreme Court allowed the drawing of a new Alabama congressional map with greater representation for black voters to proceed. The new districts, in addition to allowing something closer to actual representation of the state's demographics, also could help Democrats who are trying to flip control of the House of Representatives, though, frankly, Republicans seem to be giving them the most help at this time. We'll get to that in a second. On Monday, the special master who was assigned to draw the new maps submitted three proposals that would create a second congressional district where black voters comprise a majority of the voting age population or something close to it, as mandated just months ago by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. The lead plaintiff in the Alabama case, Evan Milligan, noted that the previous maps, quote, basically said if you were black in Alabama, your vote would count for less. He called Tuesday's ruling a victory for all Alabamians, but it's also arguably a victory for all Americans, at least those of us who still believe in democracy and voting rights. In addition to potentially sending another Democrat to Congress from Alabama at a time when Republicans hold a razor-thin majority in the House, Tuesday's ruling at the Supreme Court does not bode well for a number of other GOP-controlled states where they're hoping to continue gerrymandering their way into a majority in the U.S. House. Republicans in Georgia, Louisiana, Florida, and Texas are similarly attempting to violate the Voting Rights Act in order to maintain their white Republican majorities in the U.S. House, majorities that apparently even they believe they cannot win without cheating. Though, as I said, it has not done them a hell of a lot of good. We will discuss that and some other news out of Congress in a moment as we reshuffle a bit here to accommodate the news at the top of the show that the New York judge has found Trump and his company and his sons committed massive fraud in the New York's $250 million lawsuit against the Trump empire. But, yeah, Congress... On Tuesday, the GOP-controlled Congress, according to AP, was rushing headlong into a crisis, into crisis mode, as they described it, with a government shutdown now just days away, as Speaker Kevin McCarthy faces an insurgency from his hard-right Republicans who are eager to slash spending, even if it means halting pay for the military and curtailing federal services for millions of Americans. AP reports that there is still no clear path ahead at this hour as lawmakers return from the Yom Kippur holiday with tensions high, options limited. The House is expected to launch an evening vote on a package of bills to fund parts of the government, but it's not at all clear that McCarthy has the support needed, again, from his own caucus. To be clear, this is Republican on Republican violence. So we've got just 5 days or so before Saturday's deadline to avoid a shutdown. McCarthy is reviving his plan for a stopgap measure to prevent a federal shutdown, that a plan that was already rejected outright by a handful of his hard right Republicans who say that they will never vote for it. There's much more, as AP reports, and desperate attempts by McCarthy to avoid a shutdown and or a vote launched by his hard right caucus to remove him entirely as Speaker of the House at the same time. Over on the Senate side, just before airtime, Republicans and Democrats reached an agreement for a short-term stopgap spending plan, though it is unclear if McCarthy is going to be able to get that through the House. And at least get it through the House and still remain Speaker, you know, if he turns to Democrats in the House to help bail him out on this. I hope to cover this more on tomorrow's program. So given the news at the top of the show that has thrown us all off, we'll get to this another day. As a matter of fact, we've got, I think, someone coming on the show tomorrow, an expert, to talk about all of this. But here's another story I'm going to have to somewhat shortcut. The dam appears to be breaking in the federal indictments against New Jersey's Democratic Senator Bob Menendez, which were unsealed on Friday by the U.S. Department of Justice. He faces three felony counts in Manhattan. A federal indictment accuses Menendez and his wife, Nadine, of taking gold bars, furniture, a Mercedes-Benz convertible, cash and other favors from three New Jersey businessmen in exchange for official acts. Those acts allegedly included transferring sensitive government information to the government of Egypt, trying to thwart state and federal criminal investigations of his associates, and intervening when the USDA opposed the Egyptian government's decision to grant a monopoly to a halal meat importer, which allegedly kicked back cash to Menendez's wife. Menendez, you may recall, was previously indicted on a separate matter. That one ended in a mistrial after 10 jurors voted to acquit Menendez, and just two wanted to indict him. The Department of Defense at the Department of Justice at the time decided to not retry that case. And now, for the second time in 10 years, Menendez is indicted again on completely different bribery and corruption charges. In this case, federal agents who searched his home last year found almost $500,000 in cash stuffed into envelopes and hidden in clothing and closets and a safe and gold bars worth more than $100,000, according to prosecutors. Another $70,000 was discovered in his wife's safety deposit box, they said. On Monday, with many New Jersey State Democrats and its U.S. House contingent calling for Menendez to resign, the senator held a news conference to declare his innocence.
Everything I've accomplished, I've worked for, despite the naysayers and everyone who has underestimated me. I recognize this will be the biggest fight yet, but as I have stated throughout this whole process, I firmly believe that when all the facts are presented, not only will I be exonerated, but I still will be the New Jersey's senior senator.
It's interesting that he is going to claim, I guess, that, you know, everybody keeps $100,000 in their jackets,
sure,
in their closet. Why
well,
not?
He says that, you know, his family, he came from, his father emigrated from Cuba, and that he was worried about the government confiscating all of their riches.
You mean like in a raid where they go through and they search your home for after they've found evidence that you've been bribed?
That'll be the government removing your riches as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
But he claimed because he's an immigrant family, and all immigrant families keep $500,000 in cash and gold bars in their house. Duh. You wouldn't understand because you're not an immigrant, Des.
I will say that if you want more details on kind of the sorted timeline of all of this, that David Dan over at the American Prospect has done a really good job of sort of folding in all the details that make you go,
The sorted timeline, including what happened after he was able to get off of the previous charges, were a totally separate case, and then was introduced to his new wife, who David Dan, I believe, called her a honeypot.
Yep.
Introduced
to her. She was introduced to him just days after he beat the first rap.
And then she apparently helped him get into a whole hell of a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
It seems.
We'll see what happens.
So we will see what happens. I don't have time to go into the details now, but this latest indictment against the Democrat in the U.S. Senate sort of undercuts Donald Trump's claims that and Republicans in the House, their claims that the DOJ has been weaponized against Donald Trump and against Republicans. If you look back in history, in recent history, it's pretty much 50-50 as far as the number of members of Congress who have been indicted by the DOJ, state governors who have been indicted by the DOJ, about half Republican, half Democrat. That said, most of the Republicans in recent days have been pardoned by Donald Trump, so they're not in jail anymore. I don't know that Bob Menendez will be quite so lucky. Nonetheless, you heard him there saying he was not going to step down, he won't resign. Well, by Tuesday, the dam, as I said, seems to have burst. At this point, Menendez's own Democratic colleagues now in the U.S. Senate, not just back at home in New Jersey, but his own colleagues in the U.S. Senate are calling for him to step down. The numbers are jumping by the hour. But as of airtime, those calling for Menendez to resign include his fellow Democratic senators Fetterman of Pennsylvania, Baldwin of Wisconsin, Tester of Montana, Rosen of Nevada, Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, and perhaps most uncomfortable for Menendez, his own fellow New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, all calling for him to resign. How he withstands that much longer, especially since he was set to run for re-election next year and now will almost certainly be primaried by another Democrat, seems impossible that he'll be able to hang on. But, you know, Menendez, we'll see. Green News Report is next. I'm Brad. This is the Bradcast.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
So, is it true, Desi Doyen? This is our only Green News Report this week?
Yes, it is, thanks to the Republicans' debate on Wednesday night.
Oh, the damn Republican presidential debate. All
getting
right.
in the way again.
Well, enjoy it, in quotes, enjoy it while you can, our latest Green News Report.
Pray for rain, but we're gonna do everything we can to make sure that we're bringing every resource to bear that is reasonably necessary to help us deal with this challenge.
New Orleans declares emergency over saltwater intrusion in drinking water. Fracking operations are, quote, devouring America's groundwater amid persistent drought. Plus,
well, there's huge risk. No money, no recovery.
Republicans' government shutdown will suspend critical operations like FEMA disaster recovery.
I'm sure it'll all be fine. That story and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Climate change is real. We got to do something about it.
Yeah, this one's called autumn, sir.
So I'm sorry?
This one's called autumn right now, so yeah.
I'm sorry, I couldn't make out what you said, sir.
This climate change right now is called autumn, yes.
Yeah, that's the seasons changing, which respectively is not the same thing as the climate changing.
But the joke gets funnier every time Congressman Doug LaMalfa of California tries to tell it. This is your Green News Report.
Mr. Secretary, it's good to see you. You can see that I serve here in Congress with some of the greatest minds of the 19th century.
Okay, Desi Doyen, we thought this year was terrible as far as heat goes, but the fact that we are seeing record heat in the middle of winter down in the southern part of the globe is just sort of mind-boggling.
Yes, it is, isn't it? In South America, it is technically the end of winter, but it feels more like a midsummer. Bolivia, Peru, Argentina, and Brazil are all grappling with an unusual, record-breaking September extreme heat wave caused by a prolonged heat dome that's pushing temperatures above 104 degrees.
To be clear, this is record heat, not for winter. This is record all-time heat. It's just occurring in winter.
Yes.
Great.
Water emergency for beleaguered southern Louisiana. The Mississippi River, which carries almost half of America's agriculture exports, is hitting new historic lows due to persistent drought and extreme heat. That has allowed saltwater intrusion from the Gulf of Mexico to push farther inland, infiltrating drinking water supplies. The saltwater already overtopped a new barrier constructed by the Army Corps of Engineers to stop it. The Corps is now shipping millions of gallons of safe water daily to affected communities. Louisiana's Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards said in a press conference on Friday that officials are preparing for a long-duration event because there is no rain in the forecast.
And what we need most in Louisiana right now is more water in the Mississippi River. That means we need rain further up north in the Ohio Valley. And so that's what makes this particular challenge this issue, I should say, so challenging.
A new analysis shows the fracking industry's use of groundwater has surged recently, draining a critical national resource at alarming rates, despite persistent drought in many areas that are already under intense pressure from agriculture. The U.S. is now the world's largest oil and gas producer, surpassing even Saudi Arabia thanks to fracking. But a New York Times analysis of industry data reports that in recent years, frackers have been withdrawing more fresh water than ever before, especially in areas prone to drought. The largest fracking projects use as much as 40 million gallons of water per well, and those now account for nearly two-thirds of all fracking wells in Texas alone.
Yeah, well, what do you want? Cheap oil or fresh drinking water? Take your pick.
Pollution from fracking is also a health problem. Three recent studies by the Pennsylvania Department of Health found that residents in the state living near natural gas fracking wells face higher health risks, with significantly higher incidence of childhood cancers, severe asthma attacks, and low birth weights. In politics, as we go to air, House Republicans are fighting among themselves over whether to fund the federal government, leading to a likely government shutdown. A shutdown will suspend critical government services like food safety and rail safety inspections. And FEMA will be forced to halt all funding of long-term disaster recovery projects in places hit by climate disasters this year, like Maui and Vermont. But some good news, Ohio state regulators have suspended operation of four fracking waste injection wells that the Ohio Department of Natural Resources says present an imminent danger to health and the environment.
Well, that's good.
Finally, some good news. The Biden administration has restored the power of states and tribes to review fossil fuel projects to protect their waterways under the Clean Water Act, reversing a Trump-era EPA rule. States and Native American tribes can now, again, have greater authority to block fossil energy projects, such as natural gas pipelines and coal export terminals, that could pollute rivers, lakes, and streams and harm water quality within their borders.
At least until the next Republican president comes in and takes away their rights again.
Yep.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
One step forward and two steps back. This kind of dance can never last.
Boy, howdy. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen.
Yeah.
Thanks to all of you today for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, you can download all of them for free anytime at bradblog.com. There is no paywall there. That is made possible by those of you kind enough to support our work by hitting a donate button at bradblog.com or just going straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. Desi is Green News Report. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
One step forward and two steps back. This kind of day.